We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. And this is ACAM Learn.
Welcome to Mind the Kids. I'm Dr. Jane Gilmore, Honorary Consultant Clinical Psychologist and Child Development Programme Director at UCL.
And I'm Oma Tassi, Professor of Psychology at the University of York, focusing on children and young people's mental health and special educational needs.
In each episode, we select a topic from the research literature and, in conversation with invited authors, sift through the data, dilemmas and debates to leave you with our takeaways for academics and practitioners. Today, we'll be discussing intervention following adverse childhood experiences. This episode is called Trauma Responsive Care. It's all about me.
Right. So as with most of our episodes, I start from a position of knowing a bit about this, but not enough to do a full episode or a full conversation. So I'll start by just saying that I understand adverse childhood experiences, and I teach about adverse childhood experiences and their relationship to child and adolescent mental health. But I know very little about trauma-informed practice. So when I've heard the use of the word trauma, it's usually been when colleagues have been talking about research projects that they want to do and they want to take a trauma-informed approach. But I don't actually know what that means. But I know trauma. A trauma-informed approach is very in vogue at the moment. People are very interested in doing work on this.
And this is something I'm going to be really interested to talk to Sarah about in more detail, because although I absolutely support the idea of trauma-informed care, because there is an evidence that it has an impact on individuals who've had those experiences, I think by using the phrase, it's a bit of a personal frustration I have, because by using the phrase, it implies that there's an add-on that you then you will offer trauma-informed care, where actually there's lots of the principles in that package should be embedded anyway in good practice. So we're thinking about consistency, we're thinking about a low emotional tone in our interactions with young people. We're thinking about a curiosity about what might have happened in the past. We're thinking about a sensitivity to why a young person acts in a particular way. So although I think there is and I like the way you've said in vogue, because I think there is a danger that a phrase can be bandied around, and actually what we need is practical strategies in routinized rather than additional ideas about trauma focused care. But this is where I think Sarah will be able to help us explore that in a little bit more detail, because there is actually a resource. So Karen Treisman, and Sarah may know of Karen as well, has a book called A Treasure Box for Creating Trauma-Informed Organizations. And it's a wonderful resource. It's a really interesting book to look at. And it's got lots of practical strategies. And it would bring to life some of the ideas. And you're saying, I don't really know what it looks like, but it would really bring to life some of the ideas that I think we'll probably talk about in more detail today.
Can I ask a clarification question, which is, when we're talking about trauma-informed care, does that mean that when we provide care to children and young people, we should acknowledge that the children and young people have likely experienced trauma? Or does it mean that the principles that we apply when we work with children and young people who have experienced trauma should be applied universally?
Well, I think that's my question. I think obviously when we're dealing with a particular group of young people, there's a greater likelihood that they will have experienced a trauma and be traumatized by it. And those are two separate things, and which Sarah will help us unpack in more detail in a moment. I guess my caution is that these principles should be embedded in practice anyway, and we would take extra care, I would say, and this is how I would phrase it, but perhaps Sarah will correct me, that we would take extra care to think particularly about what might be triggering a young person, or why they might act in a particular way when they see a setting or a person or an accent or whatever that might be. But that curiosity about why a young person would be acting in a very, intense way is something that all clinicians must have in their toolkit. So I think it might depend somewhat on the population that we're dealing with. But, one never knows what a young person brings into their therapeutic setting. And even if it's not a population that we would predict trauma might be around, we just don't know. And I think it does us all a good service to have that curiosity and sensitivity about why, wondering why a young person might be acting that way and considering trauma as a possible explanation. So I don't think I've answered that question anymore.
I'm going to probe more. So what is this? Do you see parallels here with the wider inclusivity movement? So like when we were talking about neurodiversity previously or special educational needs, we think about how we can make educational practice more inclusive so that it accommodates for lots of different types of neurodiversities. Is it a similar principle here where we make therapeutic practice much more inclusive by taking this trauma-informed approach? Is that fair? Is it making it more inclusive? Is that what we're doing?
I suppose inclusive, I mean, you could describe it as inclusive. I mean, I would suggest it's more sensitive, I guess, to be considered, you know, considering how the environment might impact on a young person and how, if we have a sensitivity to that, we will allow that young person to, situational shaping, if you like, you know, setting up the environment so that they will be able to engage with the world, but also perhaps in this case, in terms of therapeutic intervention, because the environment is at its best for that young person. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, there will be individual differences and each individual person, particularly if they're very traumatized, will have a bespoke package, if you like. But I also think there are general principles that we should all adhere to, you know, in terms of, you know, routinized and low emotionality in our care could be considered part of trauma-informed care. But I believe that that should be something that we should all, you know, consider, or certainly given our, you know, have as a baseline. But, you know, I do think, and there is evidence, and Sarah will describe this to us in more detail, that of course the environmental shaping can have an impact, and a very positive impact, if we can get that right. So understanding that and understanding the nuance in that will be key to supporting young people who have experienced trauma and who are traumatized, as we said, two different things.
I think now might be a good time to bring Sarah in. So
I think so.
Let's do it. So today we're joined by consultant clinical psychologist, Dr. Sarah Parry from the University of Manchester. Welcome, Sarah.
Hello. Thanks for having me along.
Oh, no, thank you for agreeing to have this chat with us. Let's start with some very basic definitions. What is trauma?
So in its simplest form, trauma is something that people might be exposed to, and each person will respond to traumas that they're exposed to in different ways, depending on what has perhaps happened to them before that particular incident, and perhaps what personal resources that they have around them.
What are some examples of childhood traumas? So I'm trying to think about adverse childhood experiences. So maybe we could start with a recap of that. But when does an adverse childhood experience become a traumatic childhood experience? Is there a clear distinction? Is there a gradient? Is it about severity? Is it about frequency?
So much of it depends on the context of the young person when something happens. And I should probably caveat to say, my work is usually with children and young people, so I suppose I'm very, very much sort of thinking about that particular sort of developmental period. But I think it can be quite unhelpful to sort of think, well, what's more severe than something else? Because actually it totally depends on the person's life experiences and context before and around what happens. So in terms of what can be traumatic or re-traumatizing to one person might be quite different from someone else.
And I hear what you're saying, Sarah, about these individual differences, which are so important. So the impact will be different for individual people, no matter, you know, what their developmental stage. But having said that, I'm interested in these developmentally sensitive periods. So, you know, if we say all things being equal, a particular traumatic event may impact a child differently according to their developmental stage. Is that something that is supported by data, or, you know, is it entirely individually driven, if you like?
I'm not sure we've really got the answers to those sorts of questions, simply because there has been a lot less research around the experiences and responses to trauma directly with children, hearing about their unique context and setting. So without that youth-led research, it's actually quite difficult to answer those broad questions because we just simply haven't heard from enough young people from enough different situations, I suppose, to make those connections. But I think, you know, what we can think about is, well, what might be the particularly sensitive periods? What are some of the key transitions that children, young people go through? What are some of the unique first experiences that young people have? And how can that influence or shape, you mentioned before, kind of your environments here, in terms of those living environments that children are in every day? What can be contributing to shaping those and the experience of those environments and the people within them, and how can really pivotal moments sort of during those kind of scene setting moments influence how people make sense of those experiences. So I think we can certainly think about kind of sensitive periods and critical events. I think, you know, when we think about trauma, and I think particularly around kind of how we conceptualise adverse childhood experiences as well. I think, yeah, there's been lots of discussion over recent years as to how reflective of everyone's life might the list of ACEs be, and what might be some of the risks of kind of totting up an ACEs score rather than more developing a more individualised sense of how a young person is experiencing challenges in their life. So I think that's perhaps sort of where the conversation's really moving towards.
And that's really helpful. And I like the way, you know, you're highlighting that somewhat perfunctory idea. If we add up the score, you know, there's an implication that there's a greater impact. Although I know that was the early literature was sort of sitting around that. Because one of the things one of the things I'm particularly interested in is about the teenage brain. And I'm thinking about that porous quality of the teenage brain. You know, the brain absorbs the environmental experiences in order to learn so that they are ready for independence. And that it's the very time that they're going out into the world and proportionately making, you know, exploring the world in a different way and taking more risks. So the chances of having a traumatic event are increased, and potentially, you know, I'm hypothesizing here again, understanding those individual differences, that the experience will be deeper because of that environmental sponge that is, you know, that is in the teenage brain. But, you know, that's really interesting. And I respect your caution about, you know, it's not a tot up, and making these broad brush assumptions is less helpful for young people. Yeah.
But equally, you know, I think it can be quite helpful to think quite broadly as well. I think you mentioned, Umar, about how it can be helpful just to kind of look at, you know, how to make things more inclusive, because more often than not, that then makes things more inclusive for everybody rather than you know, one particular person or one particular group. And as you were saying before, Jane, you know, there are key principles around trauma-informed care, and we can talk maybe a little bit more about that terminology as well, that are, you know, are good practice, you know, to be thinking about how to make spaces feel safe, to be thinking about how relationships can be mutually respectful and trustworthy, to be thinking about how to bring in consistency and predictability. You know, all the things that we know from other areas of the literature are often, you know, key priorities across across care settings. I suppose it's thinking about, well, how can we really amplify the responsiveness of those systems, relationships, approaches to care, to respond to the individual needs of a person, perhaps if there has been trauma in their history.
Just picking up on that point on individual differences, I want to introduce the concept of coping here, or coping strategies. So I suppose one of the drawbacks of the adverse childhood experience, or ACEs checklist, is that it doesn't take into account, it says whether or not you've experienced an event, adverse event, not necessarily about how you coped with that. And I wondered whether what the relationship is between coping strategies and trauma. Like, does having good coping strategies in the face of adversity reduce the likelihood of something becoming a traumatic event?
So we did a really interesting study with frontline workers in homes for cared for children a few years ago. The study started off looking at you know, the kind of workforce well-being of that really critical workforce who often do long shifts in really unique environments and often don't have the mechanisms of support that we might have as clinical psychologists in practice in terms of very regular psychological supervision, reflective practice spaces and so on, although I think that is changing, which is great. But one of the things that we were looking at with them was, you know, when you're doing this really difficult job that brings in lots of stressors and, you know, can have a lot of unpredictability and can be a quite challenging as well as very rewarding working environment, what kind of coping strategies are helpful? And as you might expect, we found that actually sort of avoidant coping strategies were more likely to lead to perhaps experiences of burnout, compassion fatigue, whereas if people had coping strategies that supported their self-care practices and their overall well-being, their ability to ask for help, draw on supportive relationships, then that was a real protective factor. And I think, you know, one of the things that we're hoping to do through our NEST study at the moment in Homes for Care for Children is to try to understand from the young people's perspective, how can trauma-responsive environments support young people to develop coping strategies that help them with some of those same challenges and difficulties, especially given the relational losses and trauma that so many people in care have experienced in their earlier life.
And thinking about framing and how we frame certain experiences, I remember when we worked together, you were doing a study about young people who were hearing voices. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the takeaway from that work was it's a common experience amongst young people to hear voices, and it's not necessarily indicative of psychopathology. And I would take from that if you frame hearing voices as a particularly problematic experience, then that might lead to worse outcomes than if you frame it as, oh, other people might also sometimes hear voices and this is not necessarily problematic. Is framing also part of the reason why there are individual differences in the impacts of trauma on mental health?
There can be, absolutely. And we've learned over the last couple of decades, actually some things that can be incredibly unhelpful for people who've just experienced something really traumatic. So we know that outcomes are worse if, for example, someone is in a car incident and, you know, the first thing that they hear when they get out of that car is, what were you doing? What have you done? The insinuation of blame, we know, can be hugely detrimental to the recovery and well-being from people from that sort of situation. Similarly, in some contexts, this is a broad statement and there are lots of caveats to it, we know that actually in some situations following a traumatic incident, actually an immediate debriefing can be quite counterproductive, and actually letting people make sense of it in their own time, form their own meaning making and rely on their personal resources and coping strategies can be quite helpful. Particularly in terms of coping, going back to the study that you mentioned there, which was our Young Voices study, and we've had various interesting projects come out of that. We've got an intervention study running in CAMHS at the moment, following that up, which is very coping strategy focused. It's very much about, this is a common experience, but that doesn't mean that it's not really frightening sometimes or really upsetting or stressful. So what coping strategies are working for you currently? And here are some other coping strategies that young people can sometimes find helpful and that parents can sometimes find helpful to use. Let's play around with them, explore them, see what works for you, and find those multi-sensory coping strategies for those multi-sensory distress and sensory experiences. So actually a lot of our work has come back to focusing on what is already working for young people, what they've already found that works for them, and then trying to offer some additional alternatives, but with a very much kind of current focus and coping strategy focus.
And Sarah, I really enjoy your tone. You're a clinician, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I can hear that sort of acceptance and that phraseology, which is so, you know, I'm finding it very comforting listening to it, right? So that, you know, we can explore this and, you know, we'll figure it out and it'll be okay. And that's a wonderful, that idea of, you know, it's a sort of that curiosity that's embedded in much of trauma-focused care, which is just imbued in your phraseology, because that makes a young person feel safe. You know, it's not that there's a wrong or a right way to cope. There's a way that works for me and that's all right. And maybe I can make it even better with some support. And it's just lovely. You know, it's a very important and really nuanced thing in terms of phraseology and the framing, which you've just described beautifully. There was a paper that you wrote, and it's sort of related to this point. I'm jumping in here, but there was a paper you wrote about young people's experiences of talking therapy. And I think it was young people who'd been sexually abused. I think that's correct. Can you describe some of those findings? Because it sits that sort of that investigation was really interesting. Could you describe some of the findings? Because I think they sit well with what we're talking about.
Sure, I can try. It was a long time ago. I think that was one of the reviews that I did when I was training, actually. I think a lot of the findings from that review were very much in parallel with, I suppose, the things that we talk about in terms of, and I'm going to say trauma-informed care, but let's come back to that title in a bit. It was around offering choice and how choice can be empowering. When someone has been so disempowered, actually any opportunity to offer choice to help that person think, well, what do I want? What's important to me? And, you know, what do I want to get out of this? I think can be really, really important. I think thinking about the safety of the environment. So within that review, there were stories in there from survivors who had been involved in one-to-one talking therapy, group talking therapies, some of which was peer-led, some of which was facilitated by a mental health practitioner. And I remember some of those stories quite critically reflecting on actually, if you're very anxious about being exposed to further trauma when you're perhaps not quite ready through hearing about stories of others, actually that can feel like quite a threatening space. Whereas if you're in a different space and you're maybe a little bit further down the road in terms of making sense of your own experiences, it can be really validating to hear survival stories of other people who perhaps had similar experiences. So, you know, to think about the importance of the timing and when people are ready for what. And I think, you know, that's where getting to know somebody, understanding where they are at in terms of their relationship, what might have happened to them, is really, really important in terms of them figuring out, okay, so, you know, this, that, and the other might be quite helpful in the future, but actually right now, all I need to do is focus on developing a supportive relationship with this young person, helping them to feel safe in the moment, and then we can work on the rest over time. But at the moment, you know, that's the foundation that we need to build.
I think the conversation that we've had so far has focused on the direct experiences of trauma that a young person might have, but there are indirect experiences of trauma that might impact upon the young person's mental health. So there's two that I can think of. First, I think, is intergenerational trauma. To be honest, let's unpack that term. Like, what is intergenerational trauma? Because I've heard that term used. I'm not quite sure that I understand the lay use of it, the popular use of it, but I don't know the scientific term and what it means. And then the other indirect trauma is when traumatic events happen in the world that you might not, as a child, you might not be part of, but you see in the news and or you experience, you hear about it at school. Again, it's indirect form of trauma potentially, but what are the impacts of those indirect forms of trauma?
I suppose, again, it comes back to, you know, what is the context of the young person when they're having that experience? And particularly, you know, when we're thinking about types of trauma that might involve many people within that young person's family or system over time, we need to be thinking about what their bigger picture is. What are they seeing modelled? What are they seeing being experienced by others? And I think, yeah, that's where, as well, where if you think about what trauma can look like for different people, you know, we know that there are certain experiences and events that can happen in a young person's life, like bullying or a bereavement, which can be hugely traumatic. And so often it's whether or not that experience can be shared with others, supported by others, that can really help in terms of that young person either feeling empowered and supported and, you know, to be able to build on support from other people around them. Or if they might feel very silenced, very blamed or criticised, in which case they can feel incredibly isolated in that experience, and it can be much more difficult to process and take much longer to process. So whilst these terms can kind of make us think of quite concrete times in someone's life, there's huge variety in terms of actually what those experiences can look like and feel like, and the impact that those experiences might have on someone over time. And I think if we were to take something as massive as intergenerational trauma, again, that depends on, are we looking at that perhaps in the context of domestic violence? Are we looking at that in the context of people from racialized minorities? And if so, what's the wider cultural context within that, and how can that be impacting somebody in the here and now, depending on the culture that they're then within in terms of their family, their friendship groups, their school, their education, their neighbourhood? There are so many factors to, I think, take into consideration there. So again, it kind of just brings us back to, what does that mean for the individual person? And, what support, if any, do they feel as though they might like or that might be helpful to them in that time, in that moment?
Are there parallels between cultural humility and trauma-informed care? In other words, it's making me really think about that sort of individual experience and individual, I'm from a cultural context and I'm an individual in that, and I take what makes sense to me and I leave what doesn't. Would you say that there are parallels between cultural humility, or perhaps it should be part of trauma-informed care?
Absolutely. I think that's where, so let's take the term trauma-informed care. You can be trauma-informed and not supported to be practicing in a trauma-informed way. You can be trauma-informed and feel as though it's not possible to work in a trauma-informed way, which can create a lot of conflict, I think, for practitioners sometimes. And they really want to work in a particular way, perhaps for whatever reason, don't feel as they've got the support or resources or other things to work in kind of through in that such sort of that position. If we change talking about trauma-informed to trauma-responsive, then we can be thinking about things in a much more active way. So if we are responding to an individual, we are recognising their unique context and what they need. So that might include a trauma or traumas that they've experienced. It might be also thinking about their response to that trauma within the context of their identities, their intersectional experience of themselves, the people in the world around them. So I suppose in that sense, it becomes much easier to then think about, okay, well, what are the useful frameworks can we bring in to working in a trauma-responsive way that truly responds to the individual needs of the person that we're working with, as opposed to sort of working in a more linear way of applying a set of principles or a set of practices uniformly. And I think that's perhaps where kind of I know you mentioned, Jane, some of these difficulties around working or kind of talking about working in a trauma-informed care way. What does it mean? And I think that obviously varies across different contexts and settings. But for an organisation and the people that work within it and the people who are supported by the organisation to experience a trauma-informed approach, it has to be completely integrated into all levels of that organization you're working. And that's, I think, perhaps where trauma-informed working has perhaps fallen down and where it's quite difficult to keep consistently practicing a trauma-informed care way. So I think perhaps if we can sort of start to think more about, as I know many, many organizations are already doing, kind of working in a trauma-responsive way, we can think, okay, well, what does that mean in terms of how I, perhaps as a supervisor, how could I support a colleague in a trauma-responsive way? How could I support children, young people and their families in a trauma-responsive way that's responsive to their needs? If an organisation is going through stress and feeling strained, what might the organisation or the people leading that organisation need in a trauma-responsive way to support them to maintain those trauma-informed principles across the different levels of the organisation? So I think here in terms of sort of the language that we use, we can think about being trauma aware, and that's really helpful. But I think there's perhaps less of an assumption that you're automatically working in a trauma informed way if you're trauma aware. Trauma informed care is a term that's been around for a long time, and I think perhaps it has got a bit diluted in terms of what it means. You know, we can keep coming back to those guiding principles, but I think with the current move towards trauma responsive care, I think offers us a more active and engaged way of understanding, well, what does this mean for the conversations we have? What does this mean for the care we deliver? What does this mean for how we understand people's challenges and difficulties and strengths? So I think that's perhaps where a lot of the language is moving.
And that's really helpful to pull apart those, because language matters. And what I was really struck by when you were describing those issues is the importance of the environment and the system that we're working in. So if I'm working in a trauma-informed way, or I want to be trauma-responsive, I will need to have the same therapy room every time I see a young person. Now, I need to get across that particular import to the administrative procedures that are in the building that I'm working in. And that is one of the challenges. So, what happens in a room is one thing, but the environment, which relies on a lot of non-therapeutic systems, is another. And I think you're highlighting the dilemma and the challenge, so well, to think about the organization and the systems, as well as the colleagues and extended issues. That's really helpful.
I'm mindful of the time, so now might be a good point to wrap it up there. That's been a really nice conversation, Sarah. I really like how, despite me being one of those people that's like, no, but what is it? Being very flexible, subjective, all of those things which are really necessary, because I think my mind works in a very, it isn't like binary way, and that's just not. From this conversation, I've learned that that's just not how trauma works, and that's not how we need to conceptualize trauma. So thank you for that. And thank you for trying to encourage me to be a bit more broaden my thinking around these concepts.
I think it's an interesting one, I suppose, especially around kind of trauma-informed care, trauma-responsive care. Because I guess as a practitioner, if the premise that I'm arriving to something with is, whatever has happened to somebody is their story, it's their truth, I'll need to understand how to understand it from their perspective. I think that clashes somewhat with my researcher hat on in terms of, okay, so like what's the definition that we're working from? I think it can be quite helpful to sit somewhere between those two positions, at least at the moment, because I think there is still so much that we don't know and that we need to work out. In the spirit of, working through a sort of trauma-informed lens, these things take time. They take lots of different perspectives and voices to figure out. So in one of our studies at the moment, the NEST study, we're all sort of keen to see what comes forward in terms of, okay, well, how can we conceptualize and define trauma responsive care in the unique context and settings of homes for cared for children, but still knowing that that's only going to be kind of one part of the picture, and then we're still going to have to explore that further with individual people to try to develop a much more nuanced and collective kind of understanding really of what that means in that unique environment. So yeah, it's never straightforward, is it? But I think the more we can sit somewhere in the middle of exploring and looking to find out and trying to understand something from the theory and knowledge that we have so far, I think can be quite helpful.
Absolutely. I think it's a nice point to end on there. It's like a compromise. Neither extreme is probably helpful, but meeting somewhere in between is the way forward. Thank you so much, Sarah, for that really nice conversation. So thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for having me.
What a great conversation with Sarah. It's always nice to have clinical people in who also do research, because then you get the best of both. And I think that we've really seen that with Sarah, particularly Sarah not committing to this black and white yes or no it is or it isn't trauma definition, because as a researcher, as a quantitative researcher, I'm very committed to that idea. You either experienced an adverse childhood experience or you didn't. You either experienced a traumatic event or you didn't. And this is a very different way of thinking about those things.
And she did. I mean, I really enjoyed her turn of phrase as well. It was I could feel her move into a sort of clinical phraseology, and also her requirement to be systematic and identify particular outcomes was really interesting. And holding both of those positions was very important. I mean, we talk quite a lot about the phrases, the words we might use for trauma-informed care or trauma-responsive care, but we didn't get a chance to look at the literature in much depth. And actually, there is a good systematic review looking at the evidence base for trauma-informed care, and there is a good evidence base to show that it is effective. So Zhang and his colleagues looked at outcome measures like PTSD or behavioural disturbance, and they found medium effect size where a trauma-informed care package was applied. The problem was, and this really comes back, Umar, to what you were saying, is, you know, what is it? Can you describe what it is? And actually, it's quite difficult to pin down what it is. There's no manualized treatment protocol. It's a sort of state of mind or a contextual approach. And that means that there's such a lot of variability in the delivery that it's hard to capture what we're delivering. So I think you were right to say, yes, I want to know exactly what it means. And also, that's an impossible task.
And maybe that's not a bad thing. I think that's a good thing, because I think there are obviously, there are benefits to something becoming manualized, but there are real drawbacks to something becoming manualized, because, like you say, it's not just something that you do, it's something that is part of the wider system. And when Sarah was talking about this, I was thinking about whole school approaches to mental health. So the idea there is it's not just one person's responsibility, or the safeguarding team or the welfare officer at school who's responsible for the young person's mental health. If we have a whole school approach, it's everyone. It's the child themselves, it's the parents, the teachers, the TAs, the receptionists, the cleaners, the canteen people, the head teacher, senior management. Everyone is involved. And it's about the school ethos and the approach to mental health and all of those things. And it seems to me that when we're talking about trauma-informed care or trauma in general, I think that that's the kind of approach that Sarah was trying to get at. It's not something that you as an individual do. It's about how we think about these things as a system, and whatever that system is. It could be a school system, a home system, wherever, the tertiary care system, I think it is now. Yeah.
Yeah, it's such an important thing, you know, an important problem to establish, because it's so systemically embedded. And it does mean that the challenge for changing that is bigger. But, you know, we have to know the size of the storm before we can, you know, put our rain gear on. And that is really powerful. I think Sarah did talk about that tension, and I certainly could recognize that in my own clinical work. You know, if you need a consistency in terms of the setting, I just need the same room every time this young person comes to the clinic, and I can't guarantee that. And so that tiny piece of delivery makes a difference to that young person, and it has enormous implications for the work we're going to do in that room together. And it's something that I can't fix as an individual. So it was really powerful. Just to come back to the trauma responsive care, I think it's interesting, because when I was looking at the NICE guidelines, there was no discussion of this phrase in particular, but what they listed in terms of the guidelines would certainly be recognised as a trauma-informed piece of work. So thinking about the whole culture, the experiences, environmental factors and relationships with professionals. So it was interesting. I wondered why they didn't use that phrase, and it did make me come back to that idea that sometimes it's used a bit glibly rather than embedded in day-to-day experences. But yeah, it was a really interesting conversation. I enjoyed it. So takeaways.
For me, it's that as a quantitative researcher, I need to think more about more than just the presence or absence of something that I'm trying to measure, and think about the young person's experience of that. And I think in the bullying literature, there's in the previous department that I worked in, somebody used to do bullying research, and they're all about appraisals. So it's, how do young people appraise and think about the experience of them being bullied, and how does that impact upon their outcomes? And I think that is a step in that direction. So it's not just whether or not an experience happened, it's how they've experienced the experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's you hit the nail on the head. I think there are four things I took away from looking at that literature, the invitation to look at the literature. And one is, when we're thinking about ACEs and trauma, is that they cluster. So when you have one, you're more likely to have another. The second is, the more you have, the likelihood, the greater the impact is. But the idea that trauma is modifiable. So with that trauma-responsive care, we can change outcome. But the bottom line of the takeaway is that it's highly individual, exactly as you were saying. And so, you know, that really comes back to the idea that it really is all about me.